Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for being with us on this weekend edition. Asbestos, you remember that, still killing people, and you might be surprised where it's showing up still. I have a list for you. Also, there are fears of a full-blown famine in Somalia. Have some details about that. And how much does it cost to fly Air Force One? Got some numbers for you. And pretty interesting. That and a lot more coming up on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and we're online, kpcg.fm. Have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And, of course, you can listen at a few places, including the TuneIn app, which is a good one to use. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm. And also, if you'd like to send any comments, you can send those to comments at kpcg.fm. We're happy to take a look at those for you. Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live for this weekend edition. I'm Dwight Falk. Grant Turge and Abraham Blondeau have off today, so it'll be you and I going through some of this information. A lot of great information to get through today. Some interesting stories as well. Here's some headlines to begin. You remember, of course, that travel ban that was here in the United States, where President Trump wanted to keep people from certain nations out for at least a little bit, was blocked by a judge. Well, since then, there's been 4,300 refugees that have arrived in the U.S. So since that judge blocked Trump's travel ban, 4,300 refugees have arrived. And here's some of the breakdown of where they've come from. 673 refugees have arrived from Syria. 624 have come from Somalia. We've got a story about Somalia coming up here in just a little bit. 642 from Iraq. 238 have come from Iran, which is interesting. And 126 from Sudan. None from either Yemen or Libya. Of course, those are the nations that were on that travel ban list. So quite a few have come in. In total, 4,344 refugees have resettled since Judge Robart blocked Trump's travel ban. So that's quite a few that have come in since that time has occurred. And there's, of course, controversy about how much power a judge has to do things like that. In a related story, this is from the Daily Mail, Oregon judge is accused of helping illegal immigrant drunk driver escape from her courtroom while ICE agents waited outside to deport him to Mexico. And so that's a pretty interesting story. There's more details about that. It's on a lot of the major news outlets today. Judges interfering to some extent with some of the laws. So there's some controversy there about how much they how much power they have. And that's kind of an interesting write-up as well. They have an additional note here concerning the Trump administration. If you felt like the press coverage of Donald Trump has not been great, not been positive, you're right. According to a new study, press coverage of Trump's first month, 88% has been hostile. So 12% positive. I don't know who the 12% are, but 88% have been hostile to the new administration. So if it seems like it's going that way, it certainly is. Speaking of Iran and people coming to the U.S. from Iran, 238 have come since that travel ban was knocked out. How about going to Iran? Would you ever consider that? Some people are thinking about taking vacation there. So I get this paper, and it's got some just different stories in there about travel and such. And they're actually listing Iran as a place to go for a vacation. So as a Westerner, I don't know. I don't think I would ever want to do that, at least not under the current conditions. But they're saying they're opening that up. They say with international sanctions lifted early last year and new direct flights from London, Iran's tourism industry has been given the green light. There are a number of major projects in the pipeline for 2017, with the Iranian government promising 125 luxury hotels within the next few years and officially setting its sights on increasing visitor numbers to an ambitious 20 million by 2025. So one British operator, Wild Frontiers, is keeping pace by offering a groundbreaking hiking holiday, get this, through Iran's Valley of Assassins. That sounds a little bit dangerous. Maybe exciting. I don't know. I don't know if I want to hike through Iran's Valley of the Assassins, but they're offering that. If the Iranians' plans go as they hope, the country will become a mainstream destination within a generation, which is all the more reason to get in there now, they say. So I don't know that I would want to do that as a Westerner. Things don't typically go great for Westerners over in Iran, at least they haven't in recent years, but they're trying to open that up for travel. So if you want an exciting vacation, you can hike through the Valley of the Assassins. That's pretty interesting. There's a story here, of course, about Chicago. We've talked about them a fair bit over the last year or so, on and off, because the violence is pretty intense. The president has even talked, President Trump has talked about it being a sort of a war zone, I guess. And one of the big problems they have is all the guns that are there in some of those areas and all the shootings. And it's interesting here because this is a story from the Associated Press. You might wonder, where are the guns coming from? They talk about gun control and laws like that. But a lot of the guns, as you would expect, are being stolen. And they're being stolen from rail yards, trains, which is interesting. We have a train that goes not too far here from the KPCG.fm studios where we're broadcasting. It goes by. You can hear it every day. And it carries all kinds of stuff, I guess. And I don't know what it all carries, but in Chicago, some of the trains have gun shipments on them. And I suppose they have to do that to get them to stores or wherever they're selling them. And people know they're figuring out where these guns are, and they're stealing them from these railways. It says, again, this is Associated Press, Chicago's biggest rail yards have become a major source of illegal weapons on the city's gang and homicide-plagued south and west sides, where most of the city's 762 killings happened last year, which was one of the highest levels in a long time, maybe ever, but 762. You think about that in comparison to a war zone. You know, that's a, that's a lot of killings. Chicago's leaders regularly blame lax gun laws in Illinois and nearby states that enable a flow of illegal weapons to the city's gangs and criminals. So there is probably some of that. But they say community leaders and security experts say that no one seems to be taking responsibility for train yard gun thefts. And so, again, they're going, somebody's figuring out when these shipments are coming in, and they're going and they're stealing these guns off of trains. A 2015 heist of 111 45 caliber revolver guns preceded by another theft in 2014 and yet another last September all took place from the same 63rd Street rail yard. So I'm not sure what type of security they would have at a railway station. I'm assuming something. But and they're able to get in there and make some of these thefts, I guess. It says these guns that have helped fuel a wave of violence on Chicago's streets. You can imagine 111 guns stolen, and then there was another theft, and then another one. Where do those guns go? Where do they end up? And they're ending up in the hands of criminals and gang members, and of course causing a lot of problems. They say only 16 of the stolen Rugers have been recovered since the 2015 break-in, according to hundreds of recent court records reviewed by the Associated Press. So if there was 111 stolen, they only got 16 back. You know, you got 90-some floating around out there. One was used in a January 22nd, 2016 shooting. Police woke an attempted murder suspect and found one by his bed. They found one of the guns that had been stolen. Another was in a dealer's home amid 429 bags of heroin. So, terrible situation there. Police recovered another during a traffic stop. The driver said his friend had just been shot 10 times and he had to protect himself. On the night of the theft, gang members found and kept a shipment of women's sandals, according to filings in the federal case, and seven suspects arrested later in 2015. Finding guns later was luck, they say, not an inside job. So they're trying to say, the prosecutors anyway are saying, they weren't particularly going after the guns, they were stealing other things, and they just happened to come upon them. So that maybe that's the way it went, I don't know, but certainly one way or the other, those guns are getting to the streets. Corey Brooks, who's a minister there at the New Beginnings Church that is right on the rail yard, says the last thing Chicago needs is a rail yard with guns being stolen. And so we've got some sound from him, and this is a quote from, again, Corey Brooks, whose church is right there by the rail yard. And then also there's a quote from Thomas A.M. He's a Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives agent in Chicago as well. And here's some of their comments about this problem with guns being stolen from the trains there in Chicago.
The fact that there's so many trains coming in and the fact so many trains are going out, and this is a central hub, it provides a major opportunity for those who would want to break in and steal things and use it to their advantage. So it's a major opportunity for a thief, and unfortunately, they're taking full advantage of it. The bigger problem is not the transportation of these guns. The big problem is the theft of these guns not having security. That is the issue. We're already dealing with the consequences of individuals who are shooting individuals on a daily basis. And now to have illegal guns stolen and end up on our streets, it only compounds the issues that we're dealing with every single day. The fact that the railway is not responding speaks volumes. What it really says is that we don't care.
Unfortunately, it's very easy for thieves to break into these train cars. They break in, they steal whatever items are in there quickly and get out so that they're not detected.
So those some sound bites there from, again, two people up in the Chicago area, Corey Brooks, who's a minister at a church there right against the train yard where these guns are being stolen from, and then Thomas Ahern, who's a retired ATF agent. And so there's a problem with weapons, a lot of places in the U.S., Chicago especially, and they're coming in interesting ways and being taken off of the trains. So I guess I don't know, I probably won't look at trains the same way again when I see them go by our local area here. I guess they carry all kinds of things, and sometimes people are getting some stuff off of there they shouldn't. So that's interesting. That's one of the causes of some of the problems up there in Chicago. Not that the guns in and of themselves cause the problem, but obviously they get into hands of people that want to cause trouble. So that's a situation there in Chicago from Associated Press. This next story here is from Somalia. And we have some refugees that have been coming into the U.S. from Somalia. The current President Trump doesn't want them coming in for a while anyway, but we've still had 624 is more than I thought. 624 have come from Somalia since that travel ban was shut down. But people do need to get out of Somalia. There's a lot of problems there, including a potential famine. And just a little geographic reminder, Somalia there is right on the right next to Ethiopia. It borders Kenya and Djibouti, right across from Yemen, and not too far away from Saudi Arabia and those places. They're in Africa, so if you can have a mental picture of where that is or check a map, that's where Somalia is. And the people there are having problems. Of course, there is terrorism there, and terrorists that do come out of there, but there are people with some real issues as well that are just trying to escape it. They say, this is again Associated Press, fears are rising of a full-blown famine in Somalia as thousands of desperate people stream into the capital seeking food aid as a result of a prolonged drought, overwhelming local and international aid agencies. There's not enough help to go around when all these people are there. Hundreds of women and children, often the first to bear the brunt of droughts, they have been waiting in long lines in Mogadishu to get porridge in plastic buckets. Something we don't think much about here in the West, or we haven't had to for a long time. But, of course, there are famines that do creep up. And just looking at that map there with Somalia being close to Ethiopia, of course, they've had famines in the recent years as well. So there's quite a bit of that happens in those areas. And so the women and the children are facing some of those difficulties over there. They have a feeding center for malnourished children, where they're trying to help out the children and the mothers as well. And so the people are trying to get help, and they do need to get out of Somalia. But again, there's a lot of problems there as well. The daily influx of people seeking food aid is increasing pressure on Somalia's capital, which is struggling to cope with the demands. Refugee camps are already overcrowded, filling them beyond capacity. And so this is a problem that's happening in different places, particularly you think about Europe. And they have all the influx of refugees. They're able to at least feed them there, I think, better than some places. But here, limited resources and more people just keep coming and coming, fleeing problems from other areas. So refugee camps are already being overcrowded, filled beyond capacity. And the deputy director of the Somali Relief and Rehabilitation Development Organization a local non-government organization who's trying to help these malnourished children, said this month his center received 1,960 new children, most of them with severe malnourishment. So they're already trying to deal with the problem, and here's 1,960 more that are coming and are malnourished, and so they'd obviously need to be helped. It's not like they're in good condition and they just need to be fed. They have to be brought back from this condition of being malnourished. So tough situation there. Somalia's ongoing conflict against the Islamic extremist rebels of Al-Shabaab has compounded the problems of harvest failure. So they have two problems going on. Large-scale crop failure, and of course, livestock deaths also go with that. And then they're fighting this battle. And so there's a lot of people caught in the middle. Large-scale aid is needed to avert an imminent disaster, according to the Somali government. So bad deal out there in Somalia. Sometimes we don't hear too much about them other than, you know, some of the fighting and then also people wanting to come out of Somalia and get into other countries. And, of course, there is a potential for terrorists to come through in that stream. But then there are a lot of people like this that are struggling, trying to survive, and kind of caught in the middle of all those problems. So a bad deal there in Somalia. And hopefully they'll get some of the help that they do need. Here's an interesting story I came across today. We don't hear a lot about asbestos anymore. I think people from the that were alive in the 80s will remember that that was a big push to get asbestos out of the schools, out of homes, out of workplaces, because they found out that it was cancer-causing. The reason being is that when it breaks apart, it is small enough to be breathed in, but then it's too big to pass through the lungs, and it can get caught in there and cause cancer. And that has been a cause of death for certain people over the years. And so I remember being in grade school, and during the summer, they came in and removed the asbestos. And then when we went back to school, I think it was removed. But people are still dying of asbestos-related causes, cancers. And they're surprised by this. They thought the numbers should be going down. In some cases, it's older people that are quite a bit older, 70s and 80s, because one of the things with asbestos, they say, is it can take 20 to 50 years to show up. Sometimes it can be a lot quicker, but sometimes people can have a problem for quite a while and not realize it. So they're not that surprised that older generation is having some problems because of probably their exposure when they were younger. What is surprising them is that there are people that are 20, 30 years old that are, in some cases, coming down with some of these problems as well. They're thinking, where did it come from? Well, according to this website, Asbestos Nation, there are some places where there is asbestos today. And it might surprise you. They've been testing some things. And these tests have found asbestos in certain kids' crayons and toys. And so according to what they say, if you get exposed to asbestos as a kid, your chance of having a problem is much greater than if you were exposed as an adult. So they have a list of some brands. It's not every crayon that's out there. I read this, you know, headline. I thought, oh, no, because obviously my kids have crayons and things. But it's just certain brands. And here are the brands that they have, according to Asbestos Nation. So you might want to listen to this if you're a parent and consider checking out the crayons that you have. These are the brands they say to avoid, again, because they have asbestos, according to their tests. AMSCAN crayons, AMSCAN crayons. That's a brand of crayons. They say they have asbestos in them. Also, the Disney Mickey Mouse Clubhouse crayons, probably popular, I guess. It's a popular show. So the Disney Mickey Mouse Clubhouse crayons. Nickelodeon Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle crayons. If you have those, you might want to consider getting something else. Sabin's Power Rangers Super Mega Force crayons. And you can see these would be brands kids would be pretty excited about. But they also have asbestos. And then there's two kids like science lab kits that also have asbestos. EduScience Deluxe Forensics Lab Kit has black fingerprint powder, or where they can do their fingerprints, asbestos in that. Inside Intelligence Secret Spy Kit, white fingerprint powder, also they think has asbestos. They've done tests, and that's what they've come back with. They've tested Crayola crayons, and they don't have asbestos from what they can tell. So that's probably the most popular brand, I would think. At least that's the first thing that came to mind for me. So those are okay as far as their testing But these brands, again, Amscan crayons, Disney Mickey Mouse Clubhouse crayons, Nickelodeon Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle crayons, Saban's Power Rangers Super Megaforce crayons, EduScience Deluxe Forensis Lab Kit, and Inside Intelligence Secret Spy Kit. If you have those things, might want to at least think about doing something with them. You can find that information at asbestosnation.com. Nobody wants to have that going on in their house if they can avoid it. So that's kind of surprising to me. I thought that was done away with completely, but not in every case. Have you ever wondered how much it costs to operate a private plane, especially a really exclusive one like Air Force One, the one that the president flies around on? That's of course, expensive one. It's not cheap. This is from the Business Insider. It costs about $200,000 an hour to operate Air Force One, and here's why it is so expensive. So you can think of the most expensive flight you've ever taken, and it probably hurt to pay the fare, but this is next level. $200,000 an hour. Can you imagine that? Presidential travel is a highly complex logistical operation involving hundreds of people, dozens of vehicles, and a fleet of aircraft. So there's a lot going on with these flights, as you would expect. As a result, it is easy to see how the bill can skyrocket very quickly. So what does this operation entail? Here's some of what they have to do when the president flies. First, there's Air Force One, the call sign given to the Boeing VC-25A when the president is aboard. There are actually two planes that share that designation. The VC-25A is a highly modified version of the Boeing 747-200B airliner. If that means anything to you, maybe you're an airplane buff. Even though it entered service in 1990 with President George H.W. Bush, the jet's tail numbers 28,000 and 29,000 were ordered in the mid-1980s by President Ronald Reagan, so they've been around for a while. According to Boeing, each aircraft carries a crew of 26, along with roughly 70 passengers, including the president, government officials, Secret Service agents, and guests. That'd be fun, be a guest on the plane for a while. The 4,000-square-foot space in the VC-25A's cabin allows the aircraft to function as a flying White House with the ability to run a country from 40,000 feet. I think we probably all can think back to when 9/11 happened and President Bush was up in the airplane. And there's pictures that came from that where they were making phone calls and trying to determine what was going on. And so that was a time of emergency, and they were up there for a while flying and trying to run the nation and figure out what was going on. So they have the ability to do that from 40,000 feet. At the same time, the 747-200B's General Electric CF-650 series engines were replaced with the more powerful version. So I'll spare you the details. You probably don't know too much about those for most people anyway, at least I don't. More powerful engines, suffice to say. Here's a few other presidential upgrades for that Air Force One. It has mid-air refueling capability, which would be essential. It has missile defense systems, which, again, you would want. Boy, you'd have to know a lot to be a pilot on that plane. You'd have to know how to operate everything. Electronic countermeasure defense systems. It has an operating room. Wow, I guess, if somebody needed an operation. That's pretty amazing. And there'd have to be a medical crew, too, I guess. The ability to survive the electromagnetic pulse emitted from a nuclear detonation. And the communications capabilities to manage a wartime crisis from anywhere in the world. We don't hear too much about who actually staffs these planes. That'd be kind of fascinating. They probably keep that somewhat quiet, but to find out what their job entails, you know, all the training they would have to do just in case the unthinkable happened and they had to, you know, have an operation on the plane or something like that. It's pretty amazing. So that's Air Force One. They say on major trips, both VC-25As make the trip, one with the president aboard and the other acting as a backup in case of emergency. So anytime the president flies, he's got to take two planes with him. On trips, there's limos, of course, that go with them as well. The limos travel ahead with the advance team, so they are waiting for the president once his plane arrives. This means they have to be transported ahead of time in a fleet of Boeing C-17 Globemaster III cargo planes. So it's not just the one plane. There's two planes, and then there's cargo planes flying all the limos. They say, and in instances in which the president is in a hurry, he has the option to bypass his main limo, which is called the Beast, and go with Marine One, the call sign for the presidential helicopter. The helicopters, which are Sikorsky VH-3D Sea Kings or VH-60Ns or Boeing's MV-22s, if that means something to you, usually fly in a formation of three. And these are operated by the Marine Helicopter Squadron 1 in Quantico, Virginia. So that's what happens when the president flies. You know, we see that number. They say $200,000 an hour, and you think, why? But then when you read about all the things they need, I guess that makes sense. It's expensive, but yet the president is typically considered the most powerful man in the world, and maybe that's changing somewhat, but very important office nevertheless. And so they need all of this stuff to go with them. $200,000 an hour. It's amazing. That'd be quite a job to work on one of those planes or any part of that operation. And so if that's something that you've been wondering about, those are some answers for you. And we often hear the number of how expensive it is, but it's interesting to see why it's so expensive. Pretty amazing. Here's an interesting story. If you live out in Arizona area or somewhere out there, or really anywhere, I suppose, just the idea that you can see an animal you don't usually see in the wild, but this happened in Arizona. Agency reports a rare jaguar sighting in the mountains of Arizona. Somebody saw a jaguar. They saw it on their trail camera. It takes just pictures, and they were going through the pictures, and they noticed there was a jaguar walking on one of the trails. So if you hike around out in Arizona in the mountains, I guess you need to be careful. It says wildlife officials say they have evidence of a rare jaguar sighting in the United States, giving conservationists hope that the endangered cat is reestablishing itself here. I guess that would be good, although I don't think I'd want to see one in the wild. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released a photo Thursday from a trail camera that was taken in November and recently retrieved. It shows the spotted cat wandering through the Dos Quebzas Mountains, if I said that right, in Arizona, about 60 miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border. Fish and Wildlife spokesman Jeff Humphrey says it's the farthest north of the border that the jaguar has been seen in decades, making a comeback. The significance, they say, is that we're getting a clearer understanding of where jaguars occur in the borderline area. It's been decades since a jaguar was spotted in that mountain range, so it's pretty rare for them to see that. And it made me think, what would you do if you ran into a jaguar out in the wild? And really, I suppose this could go for any animal that could be dangerous. Here's what they say you should do. This is, of course, there might be some debate about this. I guess people would have different ideas, but this is the information. How to survive a jaguar attack. I guess you could relate that to any wild animal that you don't want to run into. Number one, of course, they say take precaution if you're out there in the forest hiking around. The last thing you want is to be attacked by an animal or have a jaguar leaping onto your back from a tree. That's a bad thought, huh? But I guess that's what they do. They would jump off of a tree or something. Don't draw attention to yourself. If you see an animal that looks dangerous to you and it doesn't see you, leave it alone. I think that's common sense, but I suppose there's always somebody that might want to cause some problems. So take precaution. If you see something, doesn't see you, don't draw attention to yourself. And if it doesn't spot you, just back away slowly, they say. If the jaguar or whatever animal it is spots you, they say avoid eye contact. This can be seen as a challenge. So you do not want to challenge the jaguar, apparently. They say don't run. You will be viewed as prey, plus jaguars are faster than you. That's a good thing to remember. Sometimes you see a movie where somebody's trying to outrun an animal, and they're able to do it for a while. And I always think that's not, you couldn't. That thing would catch you so fast. Yeah, almost any animal, really, even big ones, are very quick. Man was not made to be real good in the forest, in the wild. So they say don't run. If it happens to come after you, they say you should ready yourself for an attack. In this case, if it's a jaguar and it charges at you, they say hold your ground, wave your arms, and shout, making yourself seem bigger and more dangerous than you really are. He's trying to bluff. The jaguar doesn't know. Maybe he hasn't seen you before, so he doesn't know. And then if he were to get attacked, they say you have no choice. You have to fight back as hard as you can. And you have to poke at its eyes, which is kind of a morbid thought. But anyway, nose and eyes, they say, is something that they don't like being poked in, as you can imagine. And then finally, if you found yourself in a terrible situation like that, and again, it's pretty rare, but it doesn't hurt to kind of know, I guess. They say you should protect the back of your head if the jaguar does not stop, or any animal really that would come after you. Protect the back of your head. And they say the jaguar in particular is a very unusual killer. Rather than biting the neck, which a lot of animals would do, it goes for the back of the head, and because it wants to pierce the brain and kill the prey. Wow. Don't mess with the jaguar. They say protecting your head could help you survive, although this cat has very strong teeth. So hopefully no one's ever in that situation. But yeah, and you never know. I mean, you can run into some animals out there, or even a dog or something. You're not sure what to do with it. And so those are some of the different ideas that are out there. Obviously, avoid them if you can. But if you can't, sometimes you have to. And that happens sometimes. There are stories where people get attacked. Usually it's more of a, you know, in a wooded setting or like in a jungle, like on a safari or something. But it can occur. So you have to at least have some idea of what you might do in that case. I don't know that we would, any of us would remember these things. Maybe we would just panic, but I'm not sure. Here's an interesting story out of Texas. This happens occasionally in the news. You hear about this, where somebody owns a piece of land and then they find an endangered species on it, or what they say is an endangered species, and then it's kind of you're kind of tied up with what you can do with the land, even though you own it. And this has happened to a Texas rancher. Texas rancher caught in a regulatory web after rare spider found on land. Very clever headline, I guess. The regulatory web with the spider. This is from Georgetown, Texas. John Yearwood says his land is being held hostage by a tiny spider he's never seen. He's never even seen it. They have a picture here. It's from Fox News. And it's the, well, the technical name, I guess, or the scientific name is Texella reyesi spider, R-E-Y-E-S-I. So that it's a tiny, tiny little thing. You can barely see it. And it's magnified quite a bit for the photo. I don't know. It just looks like a tiny spider, as you would expect. The fourth generation Texas, the man who owns the land, has never heard of this particular spider until crews came out to widen a nearby road more than a decade ago. So they came out and wanted to widen this road. And what happens is, with a lot of construction projects, environmental impact workers have to come out ahead of time and look around and make sure you're not, you know, hurting something, whether it be a plant or an animal or whatever. And they found this little spider, this little guy. He's more commonly known as the Bone Cave Harvestman. That sounds pretty daunting. In three limestone crevices on Yearwood's land. Little limestone crevices. They hunted around and they found these tiny little spiders. I wonder if they get excited about that, the environmental impact workers, if they get excited when they find something. Probably do. The road expansion project was built anyway, they say, though at a distance from the area where the spiders were found, so they moved it somewhat. But Yearwood says since then he's been stuck with land he can't really use due to concerns about how environmental regulations protecting the spider now affect the property. He says, we call it Heartbreak Acres. It's part of his 865-acre parcel in Williamson County, about an hour north of Austin. He says the problem is not that Yearwood, or the problem isn't that Yearwood wants to sell the land, according to Fox. It's that he doesn't know what he can do with the land. He doesn't know if he's allowed to go out there or you know, work on that part of the land. He would have sometimes Boy Scout troops come out and use it for some of their activities, or the fire department, the volunteer fire department would come out and practice there and things. So he doesn't even know exactly what he can do because he's afraid of being fined or having something else done, you know, some sort of penalty. And the Endangered Species Act doesn't really spell out exactly what the penalty is, according to him. So he's kind of in this tough spot because of the spider. And he says, when you get such a vague and amorphous law and you put all the power in the hands of unelected bureaucrats who decide for themselves what they want to punish and what they don't, it's hard to know what to do. So they're not going to obviously use that area to build up a, you know, some sort of a Walmart or something. They wouldn't allow that. But he's just concerned about other activities, as mentioned, Boy Scouts or things like that, because he could have fines. There's even a potential jail time penalty, apparently. And so he doesn't know what to do with that land. Yearwood said that what the government is basically doing is making a federal wildlife preserve on his land at his expense. So he's because of three spiders. So there's a lot of probably thought both ways on this. You know, I don't think anybody wants to see somebody come in and destroy a species of animal or something like that, or a spider. But at the same time, there's got to be some middle ground. You can't just not do anything with the land, I would think. But there's different thoughts on that. Some people have probably experienced that themselves, to where because of some environmental law, they can't really do what they would like with their land. And so some environmentalists don't like the fact that he wants to do something with it. Most endangered species reside in a handful of states and on private land. The Bone Cave Harvestman is not a very appealing creature, according to Joan Marshall, who is working with the environmentalists. But she argued leaving its fate to private landowners or individual states isn't a good idea. And so they want to get in there and take a better look at the spider, I guess. Marshall argued that while the ESA hasn't been perfect, it's done what it was set out to do. The Endangered Species Act is to protect species, she said. It's done an amazing job. We have saved 99% of the species. And she points to bald eagles, grizzly bears, whooping cranes, and condors as just a few examples. But the property owner, Mr. Yearwood, remains unconvinced. He said he's not anti-bug or anti-spider. He's just not sure that this spider is really endangered. He hasn't even seen it after all these years on his property. So he doesn't know where they would be. And he does say that they've been discovered in other areas, too. So he's not sure why they're considered endangered. So it's an interesting situation out there. You know, I could probably see it from both sides, I guess, somewhat. But it is tough if you own land and you're not allowed to work with it the way you'd like to because of something like that. So anyway, you thought you didn't like spiders, right? This is maybe even a bigger reason to not care for those so much. But that's an interesting story there coming out of Texas, and you do hear about that happening from time to time. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm with a live link at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for joining us here on this weekend edition. I'm Dwight Falk. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. If you have any comments, you can email those or story ideas, anything, to comments at kpcg.fm. This weekend on KPCG, a lot of great programming. There's a brand new Key of David program, and the title is Introduction to Mystery of the Ages. You've probably heard of this book before. Some listeners may not have, but it's a really good one that you can get for free at thetrumpet.com if you don't have a copy. And it says, before his death in 1986, educator Herbert W. Armstrong wrote what he called the greatest book since the Bible. It's quite a claim, but I think once you read it, you'll see why he said that. The Bible can be made clear by this final and most important book of Mr. Armstrong. So you can learn more about that on the Key of David program. It's coming up here just a bit on KPCG, Introduction to Mystery of the Ages. And there's also a video of that. If you'd like to watch that, you can see it on TV this weekend, or you can watch the video online at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show also is coming your way here in a bit. Jeremiah Jacques filling in today here from Edmond, Oklahoma. And a lot of great information there talking about some of what's going on in the Philippines and other areas. So make sure you listen for that Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And also the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program coming up this weekend, always popular. The trumpet writers, trumpet staff go through the top stories of the week and discuss what's going on in different regions around the world. And in addition to that, if you'd like a written report, you can sign up for the free Trumpet Weekly Report. That's at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Weekly is a news brief e-published every weekend by thetrumpet.com. It contains all the reporting and the insight, analysis, and commentary that you've come to expect from the Trumpet News Magazine and thetrumpet.com. It's the world's most important news, and there's a lot of news out there, as you know, and a lot of talk about fake news these days. So this is the world's most important news in 12 jam-packed pages. The Trumpet Weekly brings you the most critical news and the insight to know what it means and where it's leading. And, of course, that's what's missing with a lot of news sites. They give you some information, not always relevant, and you don't necessarily know what it means or where it's leading. But not the case with the Trumpet Weekly. No cost, no obligation. It's all free. And you can just get that at thetrumpet.com. It gets emailed to you every Friday afternoon. And it's a PDF, so you can just read it online. A lot of people like to do that, or you can print it off if you'd like to, too. Lots of ways to do that. That's Trumpet Weekly Report. You can get it for free at thetrumpet.com. And also stop and check out thetrumpet.com today when you're checking out your headlines. The really good write-up, it's an analysis piece by Mr. Gerald Fleury, the presenter for the Key of David program. Title is, Who is the Modern-Day Jeroboam? And if that name is not as familiar to you, then there's some good historical insight into who that was anciently. And then again, who's the Modern-Day Jeroboam? Bible prophecy reveals who he is and which country he rules today. It says you desperately need to prove this revelation. So it's a little bit of a lengthy write-up, but a lot of great information in there. And I think you'll find it very fascinating. So that's at thetrumpet.com. Also, a few other pieces you can read at thetrumpet.com. Trade wars have begun. That's by Brad McDonald. The Bible prophesied that this is how World War III would start, with trade wars. And, of course, we've heard a lot about trade with the most recent president, President Trump. He's been talking quite a bit about the trade deals and how they're unfair to the U.S. And it is an interconnected global economy. So there's a lot that's happening there. And you can read about that. Trade wars have begun at thetrumpet.com. Also, another analysis piece. Experts say Iran is progressing toward nuclear weapons via North Korea. North Korea is always claiming, anyway, to have launched missiles and had nuclear tests. And so Iran is progressing toward weapons of their own via North Korea and some of that technology. And that's by Brent Noctegal. He says evidence indicates Iran has outsourced its nuclear program clandestinely, circumventing the nuclear deal. So they might not be doing it directly in Iran, or they might be, but they're not, maybe not doing all of it there, but a lot of it is being done in North Korea. So pretty interesting to see what's happening there. You can read that. Again, that's all at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you do check that out over the weekend when you get a chance. Here's a couple of health notes that are sort of interesting. You've no doubt had times where you've felt to be extremely hungry. Most people would say they're starving, which, of course, is a wild over-exaggeration. But we all get hungry at times. They say this is from a health website. The 10 absolute worst things to eat when you're starving or when you're very, very hungry. And in some cases, probably they're not good to eat anytime. But it's kind of interesting here. I thought it'd be worth taking a look at, especially because depending on when you're listening to this, it could be getting close to lunchtime or dinner time, I suppose. The number one thing they say that you should avoid when you're very hungry is you shouldn't eat potato chips. I guess that's not maybe a surprise. They say, ever wonder why you can feel completely stuffed after dinner and then manage to finish dessert? It's due to a phenomenon known as sensory-specific satiety, which is the tendency to fill up on one flavor of food but only feel like you've satisfied that one part of your stomach. This happens a lot. It's happened to me. It happens probably if you have kids. They'll do this all the time, right? I'm full. I don't want any more. And then if you mention dessert, magically they're ready to eat again. Well, there might be a reason for that. As a result, they say your appetite persists and you still feel hungry for other types of food. That's exactly what happens when you indulge in salty snacks like chips. Your body feels full on the salt front, but it still craves the sugar and glucose that it needs for energy, and you're still left hungry. So if you're very hungry and you have a bag of chips, that might take care of your desire for salt, but you might want something sweet after the fact. And that it's the same way the other way, too, I think. If you eat something sweet, a lot of times you want something salty right away. I guess that's why you have to just combine them, chocolate-covered nuts or something, right? Get it all done at one shot. I don't know. But they're saying to avoid chips if you're very hungry. Another thing to avoid, they say, is orange juice. Orange juice fails in three ways when it comes to satisfying your hunger. And again, they're talking about trying to satisfy hunger, I think. For starters, a recent study in the journal Nature found liquid carbs to be 17% less filling compared with solid carbs, which makes sense. That's why you could drink a lot of carbs, I guess. So as a general rule, you're better off eating something if you're trying to satisfy your hunger than drinking something like, say, a very carb-heavy beverage, although water can be helpful. Secondly, juices are devoid of any fiber, the macronutrient that helps to slow your body's digestion of simple sugars. As a result, drinking juice will spike your blood sugar, leading to a short-lived satisfaction and devastating crash, they say, that leaves you hungrier even. Finally, oranges are highly acidic, so they can cause heartburn and make acid reflux symptoms worse, especially when consumed on an empty stomach, some say. And of course, a lot of orange juice isn't really all from oranges anyway. So another thing they say you should probably avoid if you're very hungry, have an empty stomach, is spicy foods. Kicking up the heat on an empty stomach is a recipe for an irritated digestive system. Your stomach naturally increases production of digestive stomach acids in anticipation of a meal. And when you eat spicy foods, it can irritate your stomach lining. And so that probably depends on who you are and what you normally eat. Some people probably would love that, but they say in general, maybe not good to eat spicy foods right on that empty stomach. Number four, this one I will probably ignore, but it says coffee, because I do like coffee. They say you might think reaching for a cup of coffee because you've heard caffeinated beverages are appetite suppressants, but it's not your best bet. They say coffee causes your stomach to produce even more acid when you drink it, which will increase the amount of inflammation in your stomach lining, and it can also result in feelings of discomfort, bloat, or nausea. If you're you have an empty stomach and you're drinking it, that's what they say. Number five, rice cakes. I don't know that this will bother anyone. Does anyone eat rice cakes? That tastes like it's like eating a nothing. It's like eating foam or styrofoam or something. It never has any flavor to me. It says they're crunchy and they make you feel like you're eating air. I agree with that. But rice cakes won't do much for you nutritionally or in terms of increasing your feeling of being full. The simple carb snack ranks notoriously high in the glycemic index, a measure of how quickly blood rises in response to food on a scale of 1 to 100. And rice cakes come in at 82. High GI foods provide a rush of energy, which may help you tide over if you're about to eat a meal, help to tide you over, but ultimately cause excessive hunger and increased activity in craving and reward area of the brain. Right, because it doesn't taste like anything. Another thing they say to avoid is diet soda. It's probably good to avoid at all times, but especially they say when you're hungry. They say cheese isn't a great idea if you have an empty stomach, and because it won't help you feel fuller. They say that when you feel hungry, it's likely because your body is experiencing low blood sugar levels and needs a jolt of energy. The best way to get this is by consuming something with carbs, they say, but also food with fiber and protein to help you sustain these energy levels longer. Eat a balanced meal. I guess that's the best way to do it. They say cheese is seriously lacking in any carbs that will help fuel your brain and decrease feelings of hunger. And so they say maybe avoid that. Number eight, they say gum. Don't just try to chew gum if you're hungry. Many people try chewing gum to take their mind off of eating food. Unfortunately, this trick doesn't usually work, they say. The chewing action actually tricks your body that food is coming down. I've heard that before, and I think I've experienced that. And you're chewing, and your body's expecting something, and there's nothing. And so it makes you hungrier. And they say that can cause you to be even hungrier. Number nine, they say, this again is a list of 10 foods they say you should avoid if you're feeling very, very hungry and hoping to fill up. Sushi, number nine. They say, have you ever gone out for sushi dinner only to stop by a pizza place on your way home? No, I never have done that. But maybe somebody has. Sushi is one of the worst choices to make when you're hungry for two reasons, they say. One is that it's primarily made up of white rice, which is highly refined, devoid of any satiating fiber, and thus rapidly digested. And two is that you likely dip your roll in super salty soy sauce. High sodium foods cause you to feel thirsty, and because thirst is often mistaken for hunger, you're likely going to feel even hungrier after eating sushi. I have heard that about rice, and if you eat something with a lot of rice in it, you're going to need to eat again in the not-too-distant future. So that's one of the things they say to avoid, though I do like sushi, I have to admit. And finally, they say 100-calorie packs. I'm not really sure what this is. I guess it's a snack that they sell. They're called 100-calorie packs. It says they sound like the perfectly portioned snacks, but don't fall prey to false advertising. A 2016 study published in the Journal of Food Science and Nutrition discovered that calories consumed doesn't always predict whether you'll be full or not. Obviously, it depends on the type of calories. In other words, your stomach doesn't feel full just because you ate a certain number of calories. Reaching for a tiny packet of cookies won't always fill you up and may actually make you eat more. A recent study in the Journal of Consumer Research found that dieters perceived small snacks and small packages as diet-friendly and ended up eating multiple packets and more calories overall than when given a regular size package. So there's all kinds of psychology that goes into it, the way we our brain interprets what we're eating, the size of what we're eating, all kinds of things. So they say to probably avoid that. At the end of the day, it probably comes down to the simple fact that you should eat something that's good for you if you're hungry, and that'll probably take care of that hunger. So those are some of the interesting things from those lists there. There's always some debate about some of it, but some of the things obviously would be not great for you. And here's a related story to that. They have a lot of research that's out about what happens to your brain when you take a lot of sugar in. And, of course, in the West in particular, sugar is it's consumed at a great rate. There was even a story the other week I saw about some nation. It wasn't in the West. It was some other nation, but a small country. And they were thinking about outlawing all junk food, which would be a lot of it would be sugar, just because of the health impact on the people. And so you see that some people are realizing that. I mean, even in the West, a lot of people realize that the sugar and so forth are causing a lot of health problems because we're having so much of it and it's so refined and so forth. So, but they're doing research on what happens to your brain on sugar, as you'd expect. It's kind of like being on drugs in some ways. It is sort of a drug. They say fruit is one thing, but modern diets have taken on a life of their own. Of course, you can get fruit, or you can get sugar naturally from fruit, but typically you wouldn't eat, you know, that much fruit to get as much sugar as what we're getting into our diets. A decade ago, it was estimated that the average American consumed 22 teaspoons of added sugar per day, which is pretty amazing. I mean, if you just dumped out that amount of sugar on the table or in a bowl and said, eat that, some kids might think that's a good idea, but I think that would probably turn most of our stomachs. But you can eat that through the way the food's processed. That was amounting to an extra 350 calories a day of just sugar. And it probably has risen since then. It hasn't been getting better. It's been getting worse. A few months ago, one expert suggested that the average Briton consumes 238 teaspoons of sugar each week. So it's the West in general, whether it's America, Britain, some of those nations. The diets probably a little different, a little varied, but not great. And so this is a problem in a lot of ways. And they say today, with convenience more important than ever in our food selections, it's almost impossible to come across processed and prepared foods that don't have added sugars, and they put them in there for flavor so they can preserve the food or both. And so almost no matter what you grab off the shelf, if it's not an actual fruit or vegetable, in most cases you are dealing with a lot of sugar, probably more than we would realize in most cases. And because you look at things that don't have necessarily a ton of sugar in them, you would think, because it's not like a sweet food, but yet there is still a whole lot that's in there. So that's a pretty interesting story. And they're taking a look again at how it's not only impacting the body, but it's impacting the brain. And they say these added sugars are sneaky. And unbeknownst to many of us, we become hooked on them in ways that drugs such as nicotine, cocaine, and even heroin hijack the brain's reward pathway and make users dependent. So that same sort of thing is happening with sugar. Obviously not to the point of, you know, the same maybe type of result immediately, of course, but it still affects the brain. So that's what they're looking at in this write-up here. And it makes users dependent, increasing neurochemical and behavioral evidence. It's suggesting that sugar is addictive in the same way, too. So it hijacks the way your brain functions, and there's the reward center of your brain. They say, like drugs, sugar spikes dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens. So that's a little bit of brain information that is probably a little deeper than most of us know about. But I think we get the point. You have sugar, and it makes you feel good, makes your brain feel good. And so there is a certain addiction to that, not only on the, just the physical level, but also on the way your mind's working there as well. They say over the long term, regular sugar consumption actually changes the gene expression and availability of dopamine receptors in both the midbrain and frontal cortex. I feel like I should have a brain model in front of me here to know what I'm looking at, but I think we get the point. Specifically, sugar increases the concentration of a type of receptor called D1, but decreases another receptor type called D2, which is the one that inhibits. And so there is this chemical reaction happening in the brain. Little in-depth there on the science side of it for probably most of us, but I think we understand the point that we get addicted to sugar, and they're finding that out more and more. Regular sugar consumption also inhibits the action of the dopamine transporter, a protein which pumps dopamine out of the synapse and back into the neuron after firing. And so you can take all of the science, which is a little more in-depth, but it kind of comes down to this. It means that repeated access to sugar over time leads to prolonged dopamine signaling. And because the brain's doing that and the reward pathways are being excited, what happens? Well, you get used to it. So you need more and more sugar to get that same level of excitement. That happens all the time with drugs of any kind, right? You see that where at first, a little bit does whatever the people want it to do, but after a while, they need more and more and more and more. And that happens with all kinds of things. But it's happening with sugar, which we all consume probably more than we realize. And so the brain becomes tolerant to sugar. More is needed to attain the same quote-unquote sugar high. And that'd be the same, I suppose, with our taste buds. Something can be too sweet, but then if you eat it a lot, you lose the taste of it. Also, salty foods, same sort of thing. So it is interesting. They are learning more and more about the way the brain reacts to sugar. It's causing a lot of problems in people's health. And the amount that's being consumed is just going up and up and up because it's hidden in a lot of foods as well that we don't always think it would be in. So some interesting research there, and if people know a little more about the way the brain works, it's probably even a little more interesting. But I think we get the point of the fact that there's a little bit of a sugar crisis, or a lot of a sugar crisis here in the Western society. So kind of interesting write-up there. Make sure you listen for some of the great programming coming up this weekend here on KPCG, the Kia David program that's on the way here in just a bit. A brand new show, Introduction to Mystery of the Ages. Make sure you listen for that. You can see the video online, too, at thetrumpet.com if you'd like to. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Jeremiah Jacques. The Trumpet Hour Week in Review program, that's coming your way. Also, don't forget about signing up for the Trumpet Weekly Report, which is a free report you can get at thetrumpet.com, and that can be sent to your email inbox. Also, over the weekend, a new episode of Watch Jerusalem with your host, Brent Noctegal, from over there in Jerusalem. So he's right on the front of everything that's happening in that area. Make sure that you listen for that program. And stop and check out thetrumpet.com as well. Who is the modern day Jeroboam? That's a feature story by Mr. Gerald Fleury, the presenter of the Key of David program. Also, some other ones of interest. Trade Wars Have Begun by Brad McDonald. An analysis piece. Experts say Iran is progressing toward nuclear weapons via North Korea. And that is by Brent Noctegal as well. So he's right over there paying attention to all of those things that are happening. That's about all the time we have for today here on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for spending some time with us. For myself, Dwight Falk, have a great weekend, and make sure you stay here, 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm, and we'll talk to you again Monday.
Listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.